Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Hope you're well. We had the Fed meeting on Wednesday. The announcement, they're going to keep rates the same. Jerome Powell, in his statement, a little dovish, a little hawkish, kind of a little back and forth. Didn't want to mess with quantitative tightening too much. That's for sure, but it implied that he was definitely going to raise rates in March. So a lot to talk about there. I want to encourage everyone to go check out rebelcapitalistlive.com. That's the next Rebel Capitalist Live event we have in June, last weekend in June, Miami. We've got about four or five speakers booked already, and we're going to have 12, 13 total, and every single one of them is going to absolutely blow your mind. So get your tickets at rebelcapitalistlive.com. Let's get into your questions. Here we go. Is QE considered money printing or is it considered an asset swap? Asset swap, not money printing. If you're defining money printing by the number of currency units that circulate in the real economy, QE is not money printing. The only thing it affects are the only two balance sheets that it affects: commercial banks and the Fed. In order for it to be money printing, in my opinion, and I think the way most people define it, it would also have to affect the balance sheet of the non-bank entities in the real economy. What are the non-bank entities? Every single person on this live stream, the average Joe and Jane, business, even corporations, they are the non-bank entities. And unless they are directly getting more dollars on their balance sheet as a result of what the Fed is doing, I would not consider it QE. The only thing QE does is give the bank's balance sheet capacity to go in and make additional loans. But in my opinion, they weren't balance sheet constrained to begin with. That's a completely separate rabbit hole. So no, I think it's just an illusion. Even Jerome Powell, in the statement that he made on Wednesday, he said that they just use expectations policy. He came right out and said it. So I don't think there's any direct correlation or direct causal effect between the Fed's balance sheet and what happens in the real economy. It's all psychological when it comes to the stock market and asset prices, risk assets going up. But as far as, again, actual quote-unquote money printing, I don't think so. It only is if the Fed is monetizing the debt, the deficit spending by the government, or the banks are taking that additional balance sheet capacity and creating additional loans in the real economy, because those are the two things that create dollars. That's the domestic economy. Now, the global economy, because that runs on dollars as well, completely different topic. That is pretty much strictly the balance sheets of the commercial banks and then the non-bank entities outside the U.S. It looks like CIA is going to use war with Ukraine cover for cyber attack on our banking system. Can we stay out of the insane system? Well, I think we've got to look at the diversionary options that the administration has at its disposal right now, because if they continue down this, or if the United States economy continues down this high CPI path, meaning that the CPI stays around 7%. I was just down in the gym, as a matter of fact, and someone was there on the exercise machine, and they're, I don't know, watching the local news or something like that. But even the local news is talking about how prices have gone up. And once that starts getting in people's head, it's like a narrative that's very difficult to pull back. And I was trying to think through the other day, let's just say that the Fed does get a handle on inflation, or inflation just starts to flatten out and goes from 7% down to 5 or 4 or whatever. And let's just say it goes down to 0. I don't think that really matters going into the midterms, because there was such an extreme price increase with the stuff they buy daily. I don't think they're going to forget. Like, I used the example on one of my videos the other day on the Rebel Capitalist channel, where you've got the average gal or guy that goes and buys groceries every week. And a year and a half ago, they're paying $5 for beef. Now they're paying $10. And I'm just using that as a hypothetical. So let's just say that prices do not increase from here to the midterm elections. Is that person going to be like, oh, well, I'll give Biden and the Democrats a break because the price of my beef hasn't gone up in 3 months? Absolutely not. They're going to say, screw the administration, screw the Democrats. The price of my beef has doubled in the last 2 years. That's all they remember. They don't really care about prices flatlining. They just care about the fact that it's doubled in recent memory. So I think that inflationary knockout blow has been delivered to the current people in power. And so they need something as a diversionary tactic. What can it be? Well, I think stimmies would do it. I think price controls would do it. And I think war would do it. So how do they do stimmies? Forgive student loan debt as an example, because if they do stimmies, then they are worried about exacerbating inflation. Stimmies would do the same thing, forgiving student loan debt would do a similar thing, but I don't think they're even bright enough to connect those dots. So war is definitely a way that you bring everyone together as a group, regardless of how divisive, and we look towards our leader, and that leader, Joe Biden, you know, standing up for the country, and then all of a sudden everyone believes that he's doing a good job and forgets all the inflation and yada, yada, yada. It's the oldest playbook in politics. You guys, I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. So usually I would say the probability isn't that high, but because we know politicians' number one concern, number one priority is getting reelected, and they will do that at any cost. Doesn't matter how much human suffering lies in the wake of their decision making. So unfortunately, I think the odds are far higher today that we do see a war compared to 2019. And I think the higher you see inflation go, assuming that it continues to go up, the higher the odds increase that we have student loan forgiveness, some sort of stimmy, price controls, and or war. Do I think EV specs like Rivian will crack? They already have. My goodness. Look at Tesla today. It was down like 11%. Look at ARK, the ARK fund at innovation. Look at the ARK fund since the Fed announced tapering. They announced tapering June 3rd. And if you'll note, I think I actually had it up here. I could do a screen share with you guys if I have it on my screen. Yeah, I do. Here, let me do a screen share really quick. I'm actually getting pretty good at these screen shares because I do them so often on the Rebel Capitalist channel. So, let's just go back to November 3rd. There we go. That's when the Fed made the announcement that they were going to start tapering. And then they started tapering in the middle of November, say November 15th, right around here. And look, just straight down. So this is kind of a proxy for all of these growth, quote unquote, tech stocks that were just wildly overpriced. And, you know, a SPAC involving an electric car company is the same thing. Look, I have no doubt that in 20 years or something like that, the majority of cars will probably be electric or hybrid, for sure, for sure. But it's just like being in the middle of the dot-com bubble in 1998. And you don't have to be a Paul Krugman saying that the internet is going to be like a fax machine to be bearish on the current market. You can be wildly bullish long-term on EVs, but yet still believe that we are in a massive bubble today. I was like that with Bitcoin back when it was 50, 60, something like that. I just saw all this hysteria around Bitcoin. And I was like, you know, time out here. There's just too much emotion. And I remember I just got raked over the coals on Twitter because I'm just not some maximalist permabull. And they say, oh, have fun staying poor. Have fun staying poor and all this nonsense. And then the Twitter, I don't know, most of these Twitter trolls, whether it's in the Bitcoin space or another space, they're all just basically dudes that just are complete losers, just soy beta dudes that still live in their parents' basement. There's a lot of those people in the Bitcoin space, and they're the I forgot what they call themselves, the cyber hornets or something like that. And they make all these memes and everything. And what was ironic is I owned Bitcoin and I was bullish long term. I just said that, hey, listen, right now it doesn't make any sense. There's just way too much emotion in the market right now, so I'm just not a buyer. And of course, if you're not a buyer at any price, therefore you have to be bearish. And it's just completely ridiculous. But but my point is it's the same thing. You know, long-term bullish, same thing with commodity price, same thing with copper. You know, I'm very bullish on copper long-term, but it took a run and I was not buying more. I don't know where it is today, but another example, uranium really ran. And I was like, I'll hold off. And now this morning, in fact, I was talking to Josh. I was like, hey, look at uranium. It's might be getting cheap again. Let's put it on the watch list. So anyway, you guys get my point here. Okay, let's see. What do you think about real estate opportunities in Turkey? Interesting. The thing that Jim Rogers teaches us, though, is there always needs to be a catalyst. So I would wonder about the catalyst in Turkey. I'm not sure we're there yet, but definitely interesting. Another thing that I would look at is Dubai. I did a story on how the UAE did a deal with Wynn, where they're setting up a hotel casino there in actual gambling in the UAE, believe it or not. It's going to be a 1,000-room casino. It's going to be built by, I believe, 2025, 2026. And so I'm not saying that they're a bastion of freedom by any stretch. I do not like what their cerveza sickness policies were, but I think they're going in the right direction. They're getting better. And that, for me, is interesting, especially when you consider how the Dubai real estate market just got absolutely decimated from 2015. I haven't looked at it lately, but I would assume that it's still down and getting relatively cheap. So yeah, I think going into the summer, because of these insane policies from governments worldwide, that there's going to be some crisis investing opportunities. And I would point out that why is Turkey in the position they're in is because they didn't have enough dollars. They didn't have enough dollar cash flow, and they need energy that's denominated in dollars. So as Snyder or my buddy Brent Johnson would say, they're short dollars. Look at other countries that are short dollars. And I would put them on that watch list for a potential crisis investing opportunity going into the summer, especially if the Fed continues to jack rates as QT. You might see the dollar spike, and that would put these countries like Turkey into the no bueno zone because they would be seriously short dollars then. Where is America headed? SEC NASDAQ approve a bill that requires Wall Street boards to have female and, you know, I actually did a tweet on this today because Biden came out and said that the next Supreme Court has to be a black woman, or the next Supreme Court justice it has to be. It's like, you know, I remember back in the day when I know this is an antiquated idea, but the way I was raised is you didn't judge people based on the color of their skin. You didn't judge people based on their sexual orientation. You didn't judge people based on if they're male or female. You judged people based on their character and the quality of their ideas. Novel concept, I know. That's, you know, I'm sure most of you on this live stream that were raised in the 70s or 80s, that's the way you were raised as well. Isn't it unbelievable how the pendulum has swung so far to now they're literally doing the exact same thing? They are the new racists. In an effort to not be racist, they themselves are racists. I mean, it's just this bizarro parallel universe. It's like some woke type of Alfred Hitchcock Twilight Zone. But the bottom line is it's going to make us all poorer, Randy. And the reason is because wealth is measured by a society's ability to produce goods and services efficiently. So if we are hiring people or creating a board based on anything other than meritocracy, we are going to produce, we are going to be less productive. Simple. So if we're less productive, we're going to be poorer as a society. So that's just the price you pay. If you want to say that we have to hire a person of this skin color, regardless of whether they're the best person for the job or not, then you're most likely going to get the person who is not best for the job, and we're all going to suffer as a result. I mean, just think about how insane that is. Think about how different just men and women are as far as their interests. Now, I know that on the margin, you can have women that are interested, like the big difference between men and women, or men are interested in things and women are interested in people. That's not to say that there aren't any women that are interested in things, and it's not to say that there aren't any men that are interested in people. But it's just, you know, you got 90% of the gals that are more interested in people. Oh, there's 10%. And there's probably guys that are even more interested in people than some of the gals and vice versa, right? But as a whole, this is what you see. So if you're trying to you're basically trying to ram a square peg into a circular hole. And it's just what you're going to get is you're just going to get a bunch of people that are miserable because you're going to be forcing females to do stuff they don't want to do. And you're going to be forcing males to do stuff they want to do. And it is going to benefit some. Oh, it's true. Absolutely. But what you're doing is you're benefiting 5% of the population and you're sacrificing 95%. So when you do a cost benefit analysis, it just doesn't make sense. And the rebuttal that you always get is, oh, George, back in the 1950s, well, it was just a boys club and they just let the guys. So was that right? No, but that doesn't mean that we should. If the pendulum is way over here and that's wrong and the middle is correct, we shouldn't have the pendulum go from here over to here and say, oh, we're just making up for lost time. Two wrongs don't make a right. You would assume that would make sense. You would assume that that would be common sense. But like the saying goes, common sense isn't so common, especially in today's day and age, and especially in the United States. And this, what you're talking about here, Randy, is a perfect example of that.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
I mean, listen, one more thing on this. The idea that we have to force businesses to hire people who are the best for the job is insane. It's absolutely insane. Listen, I've run businesses. I've run a lot of businesses. And think about how stupid that is. Let's say, I'm sure a lot of you on this live stream run your own business, maybe small, mid-sized business, maybe a large business. And you've got two people. One person is going to make you $100,000 a year, and the other person is going to make you $50,000 a year. Are you going to not hire the person that can make you $50,000 a year just because of their skin color? I mean, nobody does that. Like, nobody. And the pushback that you always get from these types is that, oh, well, business owners are just greedy. They're greedy capitalists. Well, guess what? Greed cures racism. There's nothing that cures racism faster than free market capitalism and greed. Because if you are that greedy, then you're going to hire the person that can make you the most money. And if you are someone that's going to hire someone based on their skin color, well, then you're not that greedy. So which do you choose? Are they racist or are they greedy? Because they can't be both. And by the way, if I'm paying women 70 cents on the dollar, why does any corporation hire even one guy? Why? If they're that greedy, why wouldn't you just hire all women? See, if you take it to its logical conclusion, none of this makes sense. It's just all mumbo jumbo nonsense from people that have never owned a business in their entire life. And then every once in a while, I get a little pushback on that. Say, oh, I own a business. I employ two people. That's a lemonade stand. You know, talk to me in 5 years when you've got 50 employees, 100 employees. You know, what you have right now is a hobby. It's not a business. Question, hi, George. How would mortgage-backed securities be bought when the rate of inflation is higher than most mortgages? So wouldn't that drive up interest rates for homes because no one would buy? The Fed's buying them. And the Fed doesn't care if they make money or they make money or lose money. Doesn't matter. They have a P&L, but they can have negative equity. In fact, I did a story or a video on that the other day, how it's called a deferred asset. And so if the Fed has to sell, and this is a great question, because the Fed is going to potentially take some serious losses on the treasuries and the mortgage-backed securities they bought, because if they raise interest rates, what does that do to the price of the bonds that are on their balance sheet? It goes down. So they could be, and they're selling a lot of these prior to maturity. Now, I think they're going to try to let the, they're going to try, if they do quantitative tightening, they're going to try to do that by letting things roll off their balance sheet maturing, but they're not going to be able to get their balance sheet anywhere down to something that resembles normal. Because remember, prior to the GFC, that was only $800 billion. Now it's almost $9 trillion. So in order to get their balance sheet in the realm of normalcy, they're going to have to sell some stuff before it matures. And if interest rates are higher than when they bought, they take a loss. So what if they lose? Let's just take it to an extreme. Let's say they've got $100 in assets on their balance sheet. And let's say that the price of those at the $100 in assets goes down to $1. They're done. They're bust. Well, the Fed's not. You would be. A bank would be, but the Fed, of course, is not. So what would the Fed do? And in fact, the story, I thought it was just hilarious that the Fed even admits on their website. So usually corporations and businesses use something called GAAP accounting. It's generally accepted accounting principles. And if you don't use GAAP accounting, if you get, let's say, creative, you're Enron. That's when you go to jail. But if you're the Fed, then that's standard operating procedure. You see, so the Fed doesn't use GAAP accounting. Oh, no, no. You say, well, George, what do they use? They use something called Federal Reserve Bank accounting. Whoa, very cool. And magically, Federal Reserve Bank accounting doesn't really make you account for losses. And you can't really ever have negative equity. You can never go bust if you use Federal Reserve Bank accounting. Why is that? Because they have this little neat thing. It's called a deferred asset. So now, if, again, to be clear, if you and your small business or mid-sized business, or if you're a publicly traded company, if you used something called a deferred asset, you would go to jail for a good long time. But when the Fed does it, it's no problemo. So what is a deferred asset? It goes back to that scene from Wolf of Wall Street. Remember Matthew McConaughey? I use that in some of my whiteboard videos, where it's fugazis. It's pixie dust. It's nothing. It doesn't exist. It's not real. That's what a deferred asset is. But the way they rationalize it is they say, basically, we're going to put on our balance sheet an asset of future earnings. So in that example that I just gave you, that they have $100 in total assets on their balance sheet, the value of that goes down to, let's say, 10 bucks. So they would have negative equity. They'd be insolvent. They'd say, oh, no, 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 no. We're just going to go ahead and create a deferred asset for $90. And it's going to represent just future earnings, just all the money we're going to make in the future. At what time in the future? Well, who knows? Just, you know, in the future. And then we're supposed to look at that and say, oh, in that case, no problem. I guess you're not insolvent anymore. I mean, it's just accounting games and tricks. It's just so stupid. It's like a shell game. Remember that when you're playing that at the circus? That's all they're doing here. Just anyway. So that's what's going on in the Fed's balance sheet. As if you needed more reason to be skeptical of the Fed. There you go. So I guess that was a complete tangent there, but the bottom line is the Fed was buying these mortgage rates. So you could see mortgage rates go up because there is a higher risk premium, to your point, because of inflation. But then they'll probably just be bought by Fannie and Freddie. You got to realize that the banks don't keep these mortgages on their balance sheet. They just flip them to Fannie and Freddie before the ink's dry. So Fannie and Freddie's holding the bag. Oh, I'm sorry. The taxpayer is holding the bag. You are holding the bag. Because if Fannie and Freddie goes bust, who bails them out? Everyone on this live stream does. That's the way it works. So basically, you are subsidizing the loss of purchasing power by interest rates or yields on mortgages being negative in real terms. Do I think Nicaragua or Uruguay? Probably Uruguay would be a little bit better. Uruguay is a little more or a little less rustic. Let's say that. Personally, I would look at Mexico. I think there's some great spots in Mexico. So why go all the way down there? You may find a spot that you love, but I'd check out Mexico first. I don't know. Is platinum palladium good short-term play? I don't know. I have no idea. I don't really get into the trading stuff too much. I mean, what I do like right now are gold miners, and uranium's interesting. Like, I think I was saying that at the top of the live stream, but I don't know. I'd rather buy gold miners personally. To be clear, I'm not buying them. They're on a watch list, but I would just, if I was buying now, I would prefer to buy gold miners. I just want to be very clear there. Isn't there a scenario where interest rates rise, rents stable to up, and inflation up, making continued reinvestment worthwhile? I think this was maybe a real estate question that was asked above here. I mean, yeah, there's that, because you got to look at the supply side of the equation there. And especially if you got a starter home, there's not going to be any more supply of that coming online, unless all these big private equity funds, there's not going to be new supply. I should say that there could be existing supply that comes onto the market if the 10-year goes, let's up to 5%, and all the private equity funds want to kind of roll their capital out of real estate and into treasuries or something that gives them a higher yield with less maintenance, something like that. But other than that, I don't know. I mean, you could see supply side coming on because people have to sell. If we see these interest rates go up, you see stock market go down. I think if stock market goes down, I think we go from a labor shortage to a labor surplus. That means all these people that have retired unretire really quick, because I think a lot of the people that have retired are not working right now, which is why the labor force participation is so low, as a result of asset prices being high. So if asset prices go down, I think more people go back to work. I think there could be a glut of labor then, especially if we go into a recession, even if it's an inflationary recession, like we saw in the 1970s. And then you see a lot of supply coming online. But at the starter home, that's going to be the last. Let me put it to you this way. Those starter homes are going to be the last ones affected. So if you're buying a house right now, make sure, if it were me, and I was living in a normal market, you know, excluding San Francisco or something like, just a normal U.S. housing market, I would not want to buy anything over 250 grand. You got to realize you're playing with fire. And it's not that the stuff below 250 isn't in a bubble. It still is, but I just think your downside's a lot less, because builders can build a $300,000-$400,000 house and still make profit. Builders cannot build a house under 250 grand and make a profit. No chance. So you've got some further insulation to the downside. Now, it's not a perfect hedge, because again, housing prices are at all-time highs, but I would say you've got a little less risk there. How does QT affect the current banking system? Well, I mean, QT could completely collapse the banking system if we see repo seize up as a result. So you've got two kind of schools of thought with repo. Let's go back to September 2019. You guys know from watching this channel, if the Fed would not have stepped in and tried to quote unquote fix the repo problem, all hell would have broken loose September 2019. Rates spiked to 10%. What does that mean? That all interest rates in the economy would have levitated up to that level. Capital would have flown into repo to bring rates back down. And who knows, rates might have even gone higher before they came back down. But you'd find some equilibrium point, let's say at, I don't know, 7-8%. And 7-8%, I mean, and think about that for a moment. If the Fed would have completely lost control of Fed funds, they did for a moment. The Fed funds range was between 2 and 2.25%, and Fed funds went up to 2.3. The Fed literally lost control of their Fed funds rate. So don't think it can't happen. And if the Fed would not have stepped in, who knows how far Fed funds could have gone to 5%. So then you ask, okay, what does that do to credit card debt? What does that do to auto debt? What would that do to a home mortgage? I mean, you're talking about all interest rates going up by like 5%, let's say. I mean, what would that do to the balance sheets of the banks that are holding all these bonds? They would take an instant haircut. And I mean, then who's going to lend to them in repo if the asset side of your balance sheet is half of what it was yesterday? I mean, you're talking about systemic risk that's quite literally unfathomable. So there were two schools of thought there. Number one, it was a collateral problem, lack of collateral. Number two, lack of cash. So if it was a lack of cash, then what is quantitative tightening doing? And when I mean cash, I'm not talking about money printing. I'm talking about cash that's just on the balance sheet of the banking system, that's an asset of the banks and a liability of the Fed, i.e. bank reserves. This is just the balance sheet capacity that we're talking about. So if it was a balance sheet capacity issue back in 2019, then what are you doing by doing quantitative tightening? You're reducing the balance sheet capacity of the banking system. Okay, so if you reduce the balance sheet capacity, but they're same liquidity needs, that means the repo market goes into the no bueno zone. So, you know, you could say that quantitative tightening is, it gives them more collateral. But if it is a cash issue, if that's truly what was wrong, they are, and I hate to use the word cash because it's so misleading, but we'll go with it. They're extracting cash from the system. You say, well, George, what if it was a collateral issue? Okay, well, then they're subtracting collateral from the equation by raising interest rates. Because although you may still have the same amount of treasuries on your balance sheet that you can use for collateral, the treasuries aren't worth as much. So you need more of the treasuries if you have the same liquidity needs. So if you're raising interest rates and doing quantitative tightening, you are you're doing both of the things that could have caused the repo spike in 2019. Now, who knows how the internal plumbing is working now with the off-balance sheet stuff and the euro dollars. I mean, there's so many factors, but you get my point. And my point is there could be some serious risk to the banking system by what the Fed is saying they will do throughout the rest of 2022. Now, I can tell you one thing. The Fed might be okay with the stock market going down, but if the credit markets freeze up, if repo spikes, no. That is one thing that would trump, no pun intended, inflation, because you let credit markets freeze and we don't just go into 1930s. We go into like Mad Max. And I think the Jerome Powell is smart enough to know that. So, you know, I would, you can understand, you could hear that conversation between Biden and Powell, where Powell's like, listen, we've got to pull back on everything we are doing to combat inflation. We've got to reverse course. And Biden saying, no, you can't, because if inflation continues to remain at this level, I'm not going to get reelected. And my guess is Powell's response to Biden would be, listen, you effing idiot, if we allow credit markets to freeze, if we allow repo to blow up, there won't be any country for you to be president of. You're going to be residing, you're going to be the president of Nicaragua. And you think I'm exaggerating. If repo froze, and I'm not just talking about the US economy, I'm talking about the global economy. If repo froze and they couldn't fix it, just assuming that happened, it would collapse the entire global economy. And, oh, by the way, they just moved the euro dollar system, or the Fed is trying to force them to move from LIBOR to SOFR. So if there wasn't enough risk, throw that one on there for good measure. So, yeah, QT could affect the current banking system. Oh, here we go. Sorry, guys, just looking for a question. If there is inflation and Amerizuela, yeah, that's from my video the other night. What's the downstream effect on America? Doesn't every country have issue? Well, it depends on how much Amerizuela we get. So, I mean, the probability of the U.S. going into hyperflate, that's so low. That's just I wouldn't lose sleep over that. But as far as the United States experiencing significant inflation like the 1970s, sure. Or I don't know, Argentina would be tough too. But maybe like the 1970s, for sure, for sure. I mean, look at what we've seen in 2020 and 21. I mean, that continues. I mean, basically, that's, if you measured inflation the same way that you measured it in the 1970s, we would be in the 1970s right now. CPI would be far higher. So in a way, Amerizuela would be probably the best thing possible for the global economy, assuming that it was the dollar going from, and again, I'm talking about the dollar relative to other currencies. I'm not talking about the dollar relative to goods and services or assets. We've got to distinguish between the three if we want to have a nuanced conversation, and this requires a lot of nuance. So if the dollar goes down to like 50 on the DXY, let's say it from now we're at 95, 96. Let's say over the next year it goes from 96 down to 75. Well, let me put it to you this way. There's nothing that I can think of right off the top of my head that would be better for the global economy than for the dollar to go from 96 down to 75 in an orderly fashion. No way. That would solve a lot of problems. So, but that doesn't mean that it goes from 96 down to 10, right? That is a whole different ballgame. And that's when we have a whole, an implosion of, well, I can't even imagine what would happen in the US then. But so you see what I'm saying? It's to what degree? It's like taking Advil, right? If you take two Advil, it's going to be a good thing. You're going to get rid of your headache. It might have some other health benefits. I'm not sure. You take a whole bottle, you're going to have problems. So it all depends on how much Amerizuela we actually get. And it is true. Yeah, it's tough for the dollar to go down that far because several countries have the same issue. There's so much dollar denominated debt, therefore creating dollar demand. It would be tough for the dollar to get down to 75 unless, listen, if the Fed comes out and reverses course and they go down to zero in QE, they taper all the way. Then they raise interest rates twice. And then all of a sudden it starts to blow up and they have to reverse course. And when they do reverse course, it doesn't work. And why I mean reverse course, I mean drop rates down to zero again and then go back up to $120 billion a month in QE. Let's say the market continues to go down. Big problems. And so then what do? They go up to 200. Well, let's say the market says, okay, we're done with the Fed put. Then what happens? Well, the government would have to step in and do more deficit spending. That would take, the market would be so far off sides if that happened. In that world, I could see the dollar, I don't know, 75, but I could see it going a lot lower. Way, way lower. Without that type of setup, I don't know how it goes below 90 in 2022 for the reason you stated, Ravi. It's because it's going down compared to what? And it's going down compared to other fiat currencies, which can be printed, if you want to use that term loosely, as can just like the United States dollar.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Do I think interest rates have to be great than CPI to keep hyperinflation from happening? Hyperinflation, even if they didn't raise rates, you wouldn't get hyperinflation. That would have to be something way, way different. You could have 1970s inflation, but that's not hyperinflation. I think the definition of hyperinflation, if my memory serves me correctly, is where prices are going up by 50% per month, That's not going to happen in the United States with the conditions. There's no way. There's just almost a zero probability of that. Right now, in 10 years, maybe it's different. But for the next couple of years, there's just, I would worry about inflation. I would not worry about hyperinflation. Thoughts on investing in gold and silver? Would it be worth assisting? Yeah, I mean, I love gold, love silver. I think their price is going down. I like the miners. I like gold as an insurance policy, so I don't really look at that as an investment. Silver might be good speculation, but I'm putting the gold miners on a watch list, and I think they're unloved. I don't know if there's panic in the gold miners yet, but they're definitely unloved. So I'm becoming more and more interested. Okay, guys, just bear with me. Looking for another question. Here we go. How do you balance satisfaction of being right at the expense of others getting wrecked? I'd hesitate to say that I'm right. I guess some of the things that I've talked about since 2019 have come to fruition. The people talk, you know, the Fed talking about the central bank digital currency, pretty much everything I was talking about, the Cervasa sickness back in January of 2020, unfortunately panned out. It's bizarre. The things that I get called a tinfoil hatter for the most usually are the things that end up coming to fruition. I don't make too many predictions. I'm trying to think of something I got wrong. You know, one thing I really got wrong is I thought that kind of the woke corporations like Starbucks and Trader Joe's, I thought that they would not abandon the mask mandate policy until the politicians told them it was okay. And to my surprise, they, as soon as, I forgot whether it was the CDC or who came out and said, okay, don't have to wear a mask again, every single Whole Foods just done. They took it out. Trader Joe's took it out. I remember the first group to do it was Walmart. Remember that? That was back, what was that, April or May of 2021? And I was not surprised that Walmart did it, but I was very surprised to see Whole Foods just right after them. And so that was nice. Starbucks also just came out the other day and said they're reversing course on their medicine mandate. That was good. As soon as it got shut down, you can see that these corporations are paying a lot more attention to the actual laws than they are the politicians, which is very encouraging. I did not have that much confidence. I thought they'd pay more attention to the politicians. So I'm really quite happy that I was wrong there. As far as, let's see, what else did I muck up? I mean, I've talked about housing going down, but I was always talking about it in real terms, not in nominal terms. And at some point it's got to go down. So maybe I kind of have been too early on that. Maybe, I guess that's kind of about it. I remember, you know, people accused me of being a perma bear, but if you guys were watching my videos back in like February or March of 2020, you saw that I never give advice, but I was telling you that I was buying stocks back in March. You could watch my videos back then. And now I wasn't buying the Facebooks and the Rivian or Tesla or anything like that. I was just buying the commodities and commodity producers and things, you know, that I thought were a good long-term bet and putting them in a portfolio. So I got that. I don't want to say right. See the reason I'm able to have a pretty good batting average is because all I'm doing, I'm not trying to figure out the price direction. I never do that. I think that's a fool's game. The only thing I try to do is just ask myself, is it cheap or is it expensive? That's it. And if it's cheap, well, I want to buy it. If it's expensive, I want to sell it. Not interested. So it's really that easy. I mean, when I bought, I went all in almost with the real estate in 2012 when I retired. And I thought prices were going to continue to go down, but I still bought because it was cheap. The cash flow more so than the asset itself. And same thing in 2020, March, I bought a lot of oil producers and I thought that oil was going to continue to go down. I thought they would go down, but I bought anyway because they were cheap. And so I'm always getting the price direction wrong, but the actions I'm taking with my own portfolio are almost always correct. I think that's really the lesson there for investors. And what I've learned since 2012 is that I'm never going to get the price direction spot on. I'm never going to call the top. I'm never going to call the bottom, ever. I'm always going to get the timing wrong. But the one thing I can get right with a high degree of certainty and a very good batting average is just buying things when they're cheap, and or knowing when things are cheap and knowing when things are expensive. You know, that ARK fund is a very good example of kind of the opposite way of thinking, where you're just trying to predict the future. Like the business has no cash flow, so it can't be cheap, or it has very little cash flow. The multiple is absolutely insane based on the current cash flows. And you're buying it, you're calling it cheap. That is not how I would define cheap. I define cheap as buying a dollar for 50 cents. What Kathy Woods defines as cheap is buying a dollar for $3 because you think it's going to go to $5. You see the difference? So I think if you're buying a dollar for $3, hoping it goes to $5, you might get it right sometimes if the Fed has your back and all these, you know, blah, 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 blah. But you do that over your investing career, you know, 30, 40 years, it's not going to work for you because you don't have a mathematical edge. There's no edge in that. Look at Kathy Wood's portfolio. What's the edge there? I mean, Zoom, Zillow, Tesla. I mean, I could, if you told me, hey, George, just go out and create a fund that all the millennials just dream of. And, you know, people who are interested in tech that have a lot of money in Silicon Valley that don't know how to invest themselves but want to invest in a fund, just put together a bunch of stocks that they would like. Okay, I'll just do bam, 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 boom. There you go. It would be Kathy Wood's portfolio. So and I could select her portfolio in like 5 minutes. What type of... Why are we paying the fees here, right? So, again, I think those types of funds are all about assets under management. They're not really about the investing prowess of the person that's the face that I think is more of a salesperson at the end of the day. But that's just, again, it's a good example of why there's just no edge in that. There's no edge in just buying everything that everyone else is buying. By definition, there cannot be an edge. If you're doing what everyone else is doing, by definition, there is no edge. And that's why I think it's so easy to see hysteria in certain asset classes. And even asset classes that I'm bullish on long term, you can still see that they're in a bubble short term. So that's the easiest way that I can sum it up. And I think that's the best way to have a mathematical edge and to have a good batting average and to be right more than you're wrong is to just buy things when they're cheap, sell them when they're expensive. All right, guys, we'll go ahead and do some shout outs here. Let's see. Oh, my goodness. We got a lot of chats here, don't we? So we've got Randy in the house. So Sleepy, Ultimatum, Andrew McDonald, Caleb Loya, Red Sky Hobbies, Wayne Smith, Rev 68 RR in the house, Joe G, Anthony, Echoing Owl, Revert to Means, Paul Reed, Harrison Bradford, Moody is in the house, Moody the Millennial, Creature. Oh, come on now, come on, Harrison. Let's see, I already said Harrison, Electrum, Sustainable Lumber Company in the house, my buddy, JB, ATL, maybe Atlanta, Hap. Bunker, X-Can, Maxerator, Heber Cardenas, and I know I'm mispronouncing it, Cardenas, maybe Cardenas. I got to get used to, I'm going to Medellin, so I got to get back in the Spanish mode. Gun Girl Prepper. Nice. There we go. All right. Cool username. Greg Jolensky. Sylvia Tucker. Brian Berdesia. DG Ken Long. DD Crew 1. Greg. I got Greg already. All right, guys. Enjoy the rest of your evening. Check out RebelCapitalistLive.com for a list of the speakers we have so far, but keep checking it because we're going to be adding speakers. These people are going to absolutely blow your mind. So check it out. Get your tickets. They're at a cheaper price right now, and we will see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com. Or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.